All right, man. Here's the thing. I told Will not to give me the smart guys first thing in the morning, okay? Because I didn't have time for breakfast. I had like a little bit of coffee, and then he gives me you, okay? Well, yeah. I looked at your LinkedIn profile, dude, and it says that you had got a 4.0 in physics. What the fuck, dude? Why are you doing this to me? You're supposed to start me off slow and easy. Give me someone, like, give me a lightweight in the morning.
Yeah. Well, you're in luck. It's all nonsense.
It's all numbers.
Yeah.
What's going on, man? Thanks for joining.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I apologize. I look like a hobo compared
to you. Dude, you look great. Let me tell you, in that lighting, you've just got that $1 billion glow. So YC class of 2020.
Yep.
We've been hanging out a lot with your class. Some cool cats, man. How the hell did you find yourself in YC? Because everyone has this weird winding journey to how they wind up in the program. And your year was freaky because it was COVID year, right? Yep.
It was like the first, remote batch. Usually they make you go out to San Francisco for a few months and COVID kind of blew all that stuff up. So yeah, we ended up just working together out of a house for a few months instead.
Okay.
It's tough to say how that changed kind of the YC experience. I'm sure we would have gotten a lot in person, but it really does let you focus just on kind of building for those 3 months.
Right. Instead of, doing sake bombs at the sushi restaurant.
Well, they would say anyway, like you don't really meet a lot of your class until after the batch is over because everyone's so focused on demo day and trying to get something up and running before then. But I don't know. I still feel like we probably lost something by not being in person.
A little camaraderie. I mean, that's why we shoot. On the way in, I said, we basically don't allow you to shoot this virtually because, the whole reason I'm doing this and the whole reason I would even do a podcast is to hang out with cool people.
Yeah.
And then I get to learn. It's just easier. I don't want to sit in front of my computer.
Yeah, it's not fun.
I'm already doing that for part
of
the day.
I think even for like remote work, you just lose so much by not being in person, especially for small companies that... I don't know. It really sucks to be fully remote, I think, all the time. There's benefits to it, but I think it's not clear if it outweighs the costs.
Right. So you show up at YC with the idea for Blue Onion or Blue Onion plugging along? Where are you in the process when you show up?
Well, it's a little bit of both. So, I knew my co-founders. I have two co-founders. My friend Charlie, who I've known since first day of college. Mm-hmm. We were both kind of physics majors together. And so we've been really tight pretty much since then. And our other co-founder, Lindsay, went to college with his wife.
Okay.
So we all kind of knew each other outside of work and had been involved in either startup community or tech in different ways. And, we were kind of talking outside of work. And I think we had this idea just from being at a few different companies over the years that, we've seen how companies trip over themselves trying to answer very simple questions a lot of the times just because they don't have access to the right information at the right time. It's a disorganized mess in there. And so simple things about like, how well am I doing? Who are my valuable customers? What's a good cohort? How do I define that? Did I get paid for things even? Mm. People spend so much of their time spinning their wheels just trying to connect pieces of information to answer those questions that it's just really inefficient. And
You're cobbling different systems together.
Yep.
You need a specialist for each system. You need the Google Analytics guy who's going to fucking track everything the right way.
Yep.
I mean, I have the same problem in my businesses. It's like, GA is actually up on that site, but it's not over here. So, and they don't talk to each other. And then the Stripe integration doesn't really work on that. It's then you have no idea what's going on.
Right. And you're trying to cobble together. People have spreadsheets of all this disparate stuff and there's just like massive spreadsheets of trying to stitch stuff together and they spend days trying to do it. And so it's such a silly kind of use of people's time. And we've seen it enough in different contexts. We're like, there's got to be some kind of a data layer we can build in between, the end user who actually wants to consume or answer questions or make things work better, understand how to make a decision.
Right.
And the upstream kind of sources of all this information, kind of like you're saying. So, but it's hard to just go into a company and say, hey, let us build a data layer for you.
They tell you to go fish.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You have to provide kind of value kind of out of the box or what are you actually going to solve for me right now?
Right.
Even though long term, you can see how this data layer would provide like, this is how you operate everything better.
Yeah.
You have to kind of provide them with some kind of immediate value. So We kind of knew where we wanted to go, like what that North Star was, but what the initial product would be to kind of start collecting that data to create the data layer was what we were kind of toying around with in the beginning. And, you know, I come from kind of the statistical modeling AI side of the world. And so I've been working on a type of time series model, and we're trying to do some forecasting, basically. Mm-hmm. That would be our way in to like start collecting this data. It needs to be powered by something, and that data is the operating data for the business. And we start building these, help them forecast, you know, how well are you going to do? What kind of inventory should you buy, et cetera. Mm.
So, well, we're talking about e-commerce here specifically,
yes.
Right? Which inventory and predictive inventory is a shit show when it comes to high volume e-com, because if they're out of, well, I know this, one of my best friends in Miami is a e-com growth guy. And he's like, dude, if the gray sunglasses are out of stock out of 4,000 SKUs, that's $1 million in like a month that they lost.
Right.
So,
and the flip side too, is if you have too much inventory of something, you order too much, like it's a huge waste.
A million in the other direction.
Right. So that's kind of where we were trying to start. But the reason I bring that up is like COVID, you know, forecasting is only useful, right, when the past tells you anything about the future.
Yep.
And COVID just blew that whole thing to smithereens.
Tell everyone that who has an AI machine learning, you know, Dogecoin trading model.
Right.
It's like, so that only works if the past looks like the future. And if Elon changes the logo of Twitter one more time, my model's going to blow up, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, grandma's money's gone again.
Yeah. It can be quite brittle when, nothing really maps to anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we started out doing forecasting, but we quickly realized this is kind of part of the pivot piece is you have to be kind of dynamic about what you're selling. Luckily, a lot of the infrastructure we built to power those models was really this data layer, like collecting the data sources. Even when you're building any kind of machine learning model, 70% of the time goes into creating the data set that you're going to train the model on.
And making sure it's clean AF,
exactly.
Right?
Clean, like it's actually correct, labeled correctly, all that kind of stuff. So we spent a lot of kind of the upfront time cleaning a lot of that data. And then once we had to change, like, oh, well, forecasting may not be useful in the short term while things are all sorts of wonky. So we were kind of looking for other uses of it. And clearly, like, we knew other parts of the business would find value out of, you know, the data that we had been kind of organizing. And
okay.
So we found a quick, you know, pivot into helping kind of finance and accounting teams really understand what was happening and close their books every month. And that's kind of how we...
That was like the low-hanging fruit that you guys saw.
Exactly.
You're like, we could probably do 20 different things with this. But this is where we've got friction and we can pop in and talk to these people.
Because it was a completely necessary function. You have to do it every month just for your business to operate. And they're spending days just like downloading all these massive spreadsheets, trying to stitch stuff together. And it's not work that like they find super fulfilling either. You know,
it's horrible.
Yeah.
Right.
And so this is the stuff that software should be good at, right? It's kind of collecting, taking these like repetitive tasks and making something structured out of it.
To open up your time to be a creative human being that you are. Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
And to think in more abstract ways about how to fucking crush your job.
Yeah.
As opposed to the CSV file's broken again, Tony. Yeah. Like, fuck.
The column header changed on this one.
And right. So
everything's broken. Exactly. And so, you know, that's the story of software in general, right? Freeing up people's time from like monotonous tasks to be able to kind of move up value or up stack into doing something more valuable, both for the function themselves, everything.
Yeah. So, you know, the future of work, the future AI, you know, the chatbot that's going to tell your wife that you were at the bar instead of the office, right? Everyone's so fucking concerned. It's like, no. Like, you sound like a stagecoach driver as the first automobile rolled down the street.
Yeah.
You know, last time I checked, you guys aren't like, you know, I miss the clippity-clop of horses.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not the same. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not going to be the same when you never have to do a single, if you're a lawyer and you never have to do doc review because a fucking robot can do it in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you can, you know, be a lawyer. You know,
and that's one of the things that it's going to be particularly good at is that kind of stuff of summarizing information, taking long string things and condensing it into what are the salient points. You know, it's not going to be good at a lot of things, but it's going to be good at something like that.
Yeah. Really rote error checking.
Yeah.
Oh God. I mean, all this stuff that you don't want to do anyway.
Totally.
My argument in the book that I'm writing, which I can't tell you the publisher, but it's a big one. So I'm writing a book and I'm saying the future is a place where you have to do a lot less of the shit that you don't want to do anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so if you can leverage and harness the power of AI and machine learning, which by the way, you don't need to be, like my man over here, like you don't need to be the guy that builds the tools. There's going to be so many consumer tools put into your fingertips where you're like, I don't even know how this works, but it works.
Yeah. That's the story of technology generally, right?
It's beautiful. And it's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
And yes, folks are going to, there's going to be outsized wealth created for some folks who create the tools, but guess what? You're getting richer too, because you're spending less time on bullshit and you're spending more time on higher value creative tasks, no matter what your job is.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful future. That's a future of human liberation. It's not a future of Terminator style, you know, lock and load, a robot's knocking on my door to try to fucking kill me. I don't buy that for a second.
Yeah.
And by the way, if that comes true, it doesn't really matter what I believe. We're screwed anyway.
The robots got you, yeah. Well, it's all in like the pace of change too. I mean, if it happens overnight and like, yeah.
It's kind of happening. This is as close to overnight as you can get. Well, and it's breakneck.
Yeah.
But we're still like, oh, all right, you know?
Well, even with every kind of AI phase too, that there's a bit of overhype. You know, people thought that we're going to have, you know, self-driving cars, you know, years ago, and we're
God
still
damn it, Elon. Far away from that. That yeah. up.
We're not that close to that, I would argue. And, you know, even for AGI, we're probably, you know, 50 years away from that too.
So 50?
I would think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, like, it's very good at some particular tasks. I think the rate of change matters a decent amount. And I don't think it's going to be as, you know, everyone's going to be out of a job overnight kind of thing.
Right.
Everyone thinks. But you still have to plan for that.
Right. Stuff. Here's the thing though, and I've talked about this before, it's like really, really high paid rich people lose jobs all the time to technology. It's not like, you know, there's this sort of like dialogue that like tech affects poor people in this disparate way than it affects rich people. It's like, so my example that I just spoke about are the traders on the floor of the commodities exchange in New York City in World Trade Center. These dudes were making millions of dollars in open outcry trading, literally, you know, yours, my, you know, you've seen the videos,
yeah.
The screaming guys. I used to work for the screaming guys. I used to be a screaming guy for a hot second as a little kid.
Really?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. My background's in trading and we'll get there in a second, or we don't have to. Those guys were driving trucks after that. And truck driving is a good ass job, by the way.
Yeah.
Shout out to the truck drivers, because it's still a fucking good job. But those guys couldn't, what I'm trying to say is those guys couldn't command millions of dollars from the market anywhere else anymore.
Yeah.
When open outcry, spoiler alert, guys, open outcry trading is on a fucking computer board now. It's not, you know, dudes buying and selling and sweating and wearing gold Rolexes in a circle, you know, as much as I miss it.
Is that why you left? You saw the writing on the wall? And
I've seen the writing on the wall multiple times in my career. I left Wall Street, the big leave, the leave that I guess why I'm sitting here, you know, talking to you and talking to cool guys like about business on a podcast, is because I was in a high tech area of a low tech business, fixed income, US treasuries. I was developing technology to trade multiple things at the same time really fast. And even that, I was like, I'm not going to have a job at some point. That's not why I left, but that was certainly in the top five.
Yeah. Well, you want to know that there's an exciting future for what you're working on kind of thing. And if you don't see it, that probably drains a lot of it out of you.
Yeah. But you can't be Mr. Rosy about your career. You can't be Mr. Rosy about something that is changing so rapidly. Mm. You have to be a realist. Again, you don't want to be the last trader in the pit. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be the last. You could be the last trader in the pit as long as, you know, you high five everyone and you go, hey guys, I learned how to do this, you know, on screens, as we computers. I learned how to do this on screens. I'll see you guys upstairs. And you hug and life goes on the computer. You don't want to be the guy that says, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
You right?
Yeah, for sure.
And don't you have a very human sense in your body when you're in that moment? And have you ever had that moment in your career of doing something? Where you're like, I don't think this is going to be around for much longer.
Not that it was going to be around. I just knew that it, like I was in management consulting for a little while and I didn't care for that. So.
That's the most polite way of saying it.
Yeah.
I don't care for this job.
Yeah. Well, you know, the partner I was working with ended up stealing some money from the firm.
Oh, for
it was a whole mess. And then I got kind of caught up in the middle of it.
Well, that's the only way. I can't say it. Yeah. That's the only way you can make money consulting anymore.
Stealing?
Stealing. No. I'm just fucking around. But that's a job where, dude, you're too smart to... to do that long term? I mean, like, you want a bigger challenge is what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's not fun, at least for me, it's not fun to go, you know, you put together a strategy, here's what you should do, and then you don't actually get to go build anything. Right. Or anything. It's very unsatisfying.
And you're like, here's the bill for me telling you this shit, which I don't even know if it was going to work out because I might not even be here when you pull it off.
And, you know, there's isn't this executive like rotation where people leave every 2 years and then they come back and like, when they switch jobs, they hire another consulting firm to come put together the same deck that another person put together 2 years ago, rubber stamp some strategy, and they leave.
And then and ChatGPT wrote the whole thing anyway.
Now you don't even do that. Feed it all the old PowerPoint decks and you get the same thing.
Done. Yeah. What, I mean, I heard something, you do not have to confirm or deny this. I heard something horrific that the big consulting firms are outsourcing to just extremely high quality Indian consulting firms and doubling and tripling the price. So if the deck's 100 grand from India, they're selling it for 300 grand.
I believe that. So when I was in it briefly, what we would do is I would like write out the deck on like a piece of paper, send it off to a team in India and they would like make it pretty.
Yeah.
Thing. But you would write the story yourself and like, here's what I want to see on each one of the charts. But I wouldn't go through like, I want to align this pixel over here. All that
Fair enough.
They might have moved the full operation over there now.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. You basically have Indian PhDs and doctorates that are sitting down. They're actually, I was going to say they're just as smart as you. No. They're smarter than you. Okay. Let's be serious for a second. You know, and if I was there, they'd be way smarter than me. And they're the ones that are doing the deck for you. But God, that's middlemanning to the fucking, it's just apex.
Combine outsourcing with management consulting.
Yeah, what a sweet ride while you can get it.
The end of it. Yeah.
The end of it. Fuck. Okay. So like where we are today is you've been in the AI and ML space far before grandma had ChatGPT on her iPhone, right? Like, so where are we in the adoption curve? Like, what are we in the beginning, the middle? Like,
yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's still, I would say, really early. It comes in waves. You know, there was a huge hype for it, I think, in the 80s. And then there was like what you called an AI winter because a lot of those promises just never kind of came to fruition. Mm. There were a lot of good architectures and designs, but there just wasn't the compute power or the data needed to kind of power them. And so a lot of the kind of renaissance came from, well, now we have like cheap storage. There's a ton of data that's collected from just the internet naturally, right, and kind of structured databases naturally. And compute became a lot cheaper with cloud stuff. And so that really pushed forward kind of the whole community for a while. And that's what I think where we are now is we're kind of seeing the fruits of that. Mm. Like neural net architectures have been around for a decent chunk of time, but it's just now when you look at the curves of how they've evolved, you know, they get, you know, orders of magnitude bigger and stronger, faster, and the architectures change a bit, but they're not like super different than what they were.
Interesting.
And even from when I started, you know, like there was a neural net type for each type of problem you wanted to solve.
Can you define what a neural net means in simple terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's effectively just a machine learning architecture where, you know, you have these neurons, they're called. It's loosely coupled to how they think
brain works.
Yeah, it's not actually, because we don't really know how the brain works.
That's what I thought.
But it's, you know, there are these binary switches of like, is this neuron activated or not? And kind of how you structure these neurons together is kind of the architecture of the neural network. And, you know, it has these effectively weights. And, you know, you end up, any machine learning algorithm generally is you have an objective function that you say, I want to either maximize this good thing or minimize this bad thing. Mm-hmm. And you construct that function to kind of give the output that that you're actually trying to optimize for. And then you create these networks to try and learn how to maximize or minimize that function and figure out weights. Given this input, what should the weights on this network be to say, here's like a good output or a, you know, does that make sense? Or is that kind
of- I'm not done yet. Like, okay, so it's a web of independent algorithms that are connected to each other?
Well, independent neurons that are connected to each other. Each neuron basically has like, can turn on and off, effectively, but they all have their own kind of weights to determine what they should do. Given that I see this input coming from a previous layer of a neural network, here's how I should act. And how you structure those neurons is really what was happening over the last, I would say, 10, 15 years of research is, you know, convolutional neural networks were designed to process image data. Recurrent neural networks were processed to design serial data, audio, speech, text, things that have to happen.
Yeah. In a linear fashion.
In a linear fashion. And the interesting—
See guys, Nick Crown knew one word right there.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Well, because an image you can process simultaneously, and audio is a time, there's a time factor to it. It moves in one direction.
Exactly. Yeah. And like the word before impacts the next word that you would see.
Cascading effect.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas like it's an image is spatial, right? Like the pixel here, you know, impacts all the pixels around it, but it's not necessarily like linear.
Which is why you can take a finger, well, you can take a fingerprint of a song too. Shazam, you guys have clearly got that on lock.
Yeah.
But the fingerprint of an image is you can select a cluster of random pixels. It's very lightweight and you can understand what an image is really fast, right? I mean,
For sure. And so but each one of those kind of domains was optimized in and of itself. And I think in 2016, when that transformer paper came out of Google, it all started to converge really on this new architecture of transformers, which can process kind of all sorts of different types of data, text, image, video.
They're flexible.
A little bit more flexible. It's kind of converging into one. And that is a lot of the power that you see now. All of ChatGPT, I mean, the T is transformer in GPT. And that's the architecture that's really blown up, I think, over the last few years. Mm.
So it says, I don't care what you feed me.
The innovations there are something called attention, self-attention, and you know, basically how the neurons kind of communicate with each other. What kind of information can they use from other parts of the network? And it just allows it to be a lot smarter. They're less kind of hyper-focused on one little thing and can optimize in over kind of a broader sense of themselves.
Right. And let's touch on why you need humans to train.
It's a great,
these things.
It's a great question. This is, you know, I'm sure you've seen hallucinations that come out of things like GPT. The reason for that is that they don't really have a lot of humans telling them this is good or this is bad. It's just, here's a bunch of text. And, so you ask a question to it. It's not actually trying to understand the question that you're asking. It's trying to piece together an answer that I think sounds like
maybe it's a best guess
question. Yeah. And it's trying to mimic, right? Given the word before, can I predict the next word? Just why prompt engineering matters so much, right?
Yeah.
You need to ask it in the right way because it's kind of.
Yeah. And guys, so prompt engineering is everyone's doing it and you don't even know you're doing it. When you say, rewrite this sentence in an interesting way that might make Sherlock Holmes want to read. Like, it's like, that's a prompt.
Yep.
And there's an entire field of prompt starting engineering now, where you're like, I'm a specialist in getting the robot to tell me exactly the way that we want it. You know, an inspiring piece in 3,600 words that does this, this, and this, and has, you know, references to the Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Prompt engineering.
Exactly. I would be surprised. That's going to be a short-lived field, I imagine, but it's going to be pretty hype.
Because machines will start to write prompts.
They'll get better at it. Yeah. Like, or understanding what you're saying, you'll be able to be more flexible with how you talk to some of these things.
Right.
It'll be
which you're already seeing with GPT-4 versus GPT-3.
Yep.
GPT-3, you need to nudge that little sucker a little bit more. And now GPT-4, it's like, I got you, bro.
Yeah.
It's like, I already kind of know what you're trying to say.
Totally.
which is the whoa factor that folks have, including myself, when they interact now with GPT-4.
Yep. And so because it's trying to do like word prediction, it's trying to stay on topic and trying to create something semantically useful, but it's not really being trained to say this is accurate or not, which is why you get like, you know, you can ask it, you know, make up some person, give me the biography of some 17th century philosopher. And it'll just make up a biography of a guy that didn't exist kind of thing. It's like, this sounds right. This sounds like a 17th century French guy, you know?
Right. I've got friends that do this, I think. And they're, they were doing that way before GPT-3 and 4.
Us, yeah. But it's not penalized right now for giving false answers. And I think that to your point about human in the loop, why is it important for humans to kind of provide that feedback to say if something is right or wrong? Mm-hmm. I mean, in the kind of old style of kind of supervised machine learning, it's not the old style, it's still the current style. You have to label data to say this is correct or not correct.
Yeah.
And that's how, you know, you optimize and learn rather than just kind of feeding it a bunch of text and saying, here's kind of what the world is. And so I do think how they're going to make those hallucinations stop or get better is providing exactly what you said, humans going in and adding some reinforcement learning techniques to say, this is the right thing to do or wrong thing to do.
Well, what everyone, you know, I think everyone I don't know. Does everyone realize that they've trained the model by using it?
I don't think so.
Okay. So the reason that GPT was free, I don't think it's free anymore.
It's
not, Okay. So the reason it was free and the reason that however many millions of people used it over the course of a month or whatever the open period was because you are the best free workforce ever to exist. All you millions of people, thank you for making our model smarter.
And their product better.
You know, You guys rule. Because in that month, when I let you play, I'm obviously pretending I'm Sam Altman right now. When I let you play with my little chatbot, you were the humans telling me if something was inaccurate or bad. So yeah, the thumbs up, thumbs down, right? The most innocuous, innocent looking little fucking emoji. It's like, that emoji is like, that is like Ivan Drago, Rocky IV. It's just like, if he dies, he dies. It's like, is prompt good? Good. Yep. Prompt bad? He dies.
Kind of, yeah.
And that's machine learning, everybody.
You're providing that labeled data for them to kind of help with it. I mean, it's not free anymore. And that's probably a good thing, but still it's incredibly powerful. I still think it's not going, you know, it's overhyped, I think, for what it's going to be able to do, but people don't really know yet, you know, what is it going to be really good at? The products are just starting to be built on top of that layer, I think, to figure that piece out.
I mean, I have a product built on top of that layer. So, you know, for me, the area that I'm interested in is, we talk about redundant, whatever, is like simple research about somebody might take you 5 to 10 minutes, and we can obviously do that in seconds at scale with AI and using the GPT model, right? Yep. Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm doing now. Before I'm about to do something rote, redundant, research-oriented, I ask GPT first. And sometimes I get what I need. And guess what? That was a fucking free hour of labor for me.
Right.
You know, I was writing, I don't know if you signed it. Hopefully you signed it. Everyone's supposed to sign it. Will, did he sign it? I have an agreement before you come on the podcast. You know, I could either have my baller lawyer write it for me for $1,000, or I can, because I'm familiar with these types of documents, or I can have GPT-4 write me the most beautiful legal document in 30 seconds.
Yeah, right.
It's which happened.
Yeah. I didn't sign anything, by the way.
God damn. But son of a... We're going to resend it to you. It's too late. You're already on and you haven't tripped and fallen. So you're okay.
There's time. There's time for me to fall.
There's time for you to twist your ankle.
Yeah.
I might and sue me.
Yeah, right.
Try to pierce the LLC, pal. You can't do it.
As long as you have it somewhere in the Caribbean, yeah.
Yeah. No. I'm, you know, I share a room with Sam Bankman-Fried down in the islands.
Yeah.
So if we're like, we have a cleanliness of a data set, companies throw off shit tons of data. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, I can impact. The accounting guys love me. Are you focusing on just drilling down and solving that solution? You say, okay, well now we got these guys. Now we could start to offer some other solutions and build this basket. What is Blue Onion? Where are you guys headed?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we do think there's a ton of value, like I said, in the data set itself. Mm-hmm. And so our goal, I think, really long-term is to make that data layer kind of the operating system for a business. So right now we, like you said, we service kind of the finance and accounting folks on their team where we help them do reconciliation. We help streamline that process. And we kind of consider that potentially one application that sits on top of this data layer. Mm. So, you know, we want the data layer to be kind of the Microsoft Windows piece of it.
I see.
Our reconciliation thing is the Solitaire or the Minesweeper or whatever you want to call it. And then either us or other folks can build other applications that sit on top of that data. We can go back to the forecasting piece, right? It takes the same data set to feed these forecasting algorithms.
Sure.
Inventory optimization and management, that's another application that kind of sit on top of that data layer. And so, if, you know, we can kind of keep adding in these new sources of data to be able to get a more and more complete picture of how a business operates. All these applications can just be set on top of them. You can plug and play these things to say, you know, here is how I want my business to look. And it's all fed off of the same source of truth data, which to us, we've kind of reconciled this data to your bank account. We know this is true because you say this is an order and you got paid for it on this day.
Yeah.
And that is the truth. And companies argue so much over what actually happened because they don't know, should I believe this database or this database? Mm. And once you reconcile something to cash, you know that it's true.
So you're triangulating the truth or...
Exactly. Through these different data sources, we can kind of piece together. We create like the audit trail to say, here's actually what happened. And all the discrepancies, you want to go look at the discrepancies. You think you sold this, you think this happened,
right.
And you can't find anything over here to kind of confirm that that's
right. And we're cleaning data. Mm-hmm. We're building these massive databases. Where does the AI and machine learning component fit into this?
Yeah. Like, in a few different places. And so... you know, one, I'm never trying to shoehorn kind of algorithms we don't need in there. Like we're not doing generative AI or anything like that on there. That's not kind of what's needed. What we do a lot of are things like anomaly detection for when do things happen. So that is a subfield of like type of, you know, machine learning algorithm. What is bizarre about this data? What should you be paying attention to? Either your chargeback rate or something like that went up super high really quickly, or even how we match things across systems. Now that should be mostly deterministic in that, like, here's a key, we can find this key over here and we can stitch it together. Uh-huh. When you can't, or when there's not keys, we do use kind of some fuzzy logic in algorithmic matching to say, this is likely this thing. And because we don't have any collisions over here, we're going to stitch these records together and call this kind of true and reconcile to the bank.
There I see. Well. So if it doesn't match perfectly, we approximate what a human would do and go, it's not the same code because it came from Chase and this is over here. But I know it's the same transaction.
We're pretty sure it's the same thing. Yeah. And so like, you know, and then there's levels for us to say, like, you should review this, or we're pretty confident that this is actually correct. And so rather than them having to
a human review layer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So rather than, because, you know, this is where generative AI is good, right, is where the cost of being wrong is not that high, like sending out an email or something like
that. Oh, yeah.
And in accounting, it's a little bit harder to be, you don't want to have incorrect numbers. And that's something that we tried to find the right balance of moving quickly, but still not showing them incorrect numbers
thing
at the same time, where we want to make sure we have the right checks in place. And so we do this kind of through layers of, here's what we're damn sure is correct because you can trace everything exactly. Here's what we're pretty sure is correct. And then here are the things that you should review because it may not be the case that our confidence is not super high.
I see. So that's really beautiful that you can kind of approach the entire field in terms of what's the cost of being wrong. Because the first tools, including myself, the tool that I've built, the cost of being wrong is really low, right? Where, hey, I didn't really describe for my tool, which is generative, I didn't really describe the award that you won in for doing this thing quite the right way semantically. And it's all right.
Worst case, someone opens up an email and they're like,
Right. And well, the comedy here is your VA or your outsourced copywriting team would have probably made the same fucking mistake.
Right.
And didn't semantically understand what that thing means. So you have this low risk, high reward opportunity to send an email and to get in most of our studies, get a higher response rate.
Right.
And your downside is, I just deleted the email.
And that's where it's great right now.
Yes. Yes. And where we're headed is where we start to apply and hand over the keys to more risky things, or at least allow a human layer of review. Yep. I'm assuming it. We know it's already in medicine where there's anomaly detection and then there's a doctor or surgeon, whatever, review. Mm-hmm. What takes us to an environment where we give more and more control, cleanliness of data, more data? What happens where we just go, no, that's a disease. The machines, that's 100% a disease. I don't even need to look at it.
Right.
How do we get there?
It's a great question. I mean, you're right. The quality of the data really matters more than anything, which is why in certain applications in medicine, which the example you gave is, it's a lot easier than others. When the output of a diagnostic test is digital, an X-ray or something like that, it's easy to create a fairly standardized set of data to pass into there. But then there's also very silly things like, can read the wrong thing in images if the data is not structured correctly to kind of bias the data set for one way versus the other. It's really hard to generate a completely unbiased set of data to be really good in all scenarios. Because like certain groups of people will get these diagnostic tests more than others. And so it's going to be trained on that data set right, a lot better than, you know, for some group that doesn't get great medical care or something like that. And so
you'd need an omnibus data set for the entire world. Every single scan harmonized from every single patient.
Well, yeah, the data needs to be clean and
the singularity is approaching.
The singularity in very particular tasks. I think that's where I'm kind of most excited about it is, you know, these things are very good if you give it a very strong, clear task to do and like the right data to kind of feed it. So something like a diagnostic test would be really good. Like it is rote, right? A machine should be better at doing this than a human. A doctor can be trained on maybe looked at thousands of kind of these tests over their career. A machine can be trained on looking at hundreds of millions of them potentially.
Yeah.
But it's, again, easy to have some kind of bias if the data that's being fed into it is not,
right,
you know, properly debiased. So,
well, what people describe as feel, they're the magic of feel. You know what? We've all heard the stories. The doctor looks at, you know, Aunt Susie's face and he goes, "You need to go to the hospital right now." Because there's a constellation of data points that he recognizes that you don't. Her brow is a little red. Her face is slightly has a tone to it, right? Yep. He doesn't know. It's magic to him and to the whole barbecue, family barbecue. Yep. But he knows that Aunt Susie needs to go to the hospital immediately because she's about to have a stroke or some kind of thing, right?
Right.
Now, that's this argument for machines could never do that.
Right.
But what you just said is, well, you know, doctor, your uncle who's a doctor has seen thousands, maybe 10,000 data points. It's a good data set for one human, certainly bigger than mine, right? Now, a machine with a million data points, does he catch Aunt Susie before she even leaves for the barbecue?
Yeah, potentially.
Potentially.
It's all in what data gets kind of fed into it. What are the, what's it trained on? I still am more excited about getting the narrow problems right first before trying to like expand those concentric circles of kind of triangulating across things. And that's what humans are going to continue to be good at. Like, let the test stuff happen, I think, with machines. Let the triaging and figuring out how it's all connected still happen by humans, and then they'll get smarter and smarter over time. And we'll start to, you know, offload more and more.
Right.
But, you know, medical data is pretty unstructured, especially like the text pieces of it.
It's designed to be a shit show.
Absolutely. It's designed for billing. It's not designed for for actual care.
Right. And to the fractionalized billing environment of states, for, you know, Jersey versus New York and this office versus that.
Right. I mean, there's a whole like slew of startups that wanted to do like the EMR, the medical record 2.0, that is designed around care instead of billing, but it's not going to, I mean, hospitals care about billing. They don't really care about the care part as much.
Yeah.
Or at least that's not what they're optimizing for.
Right. Yeah. Medicine. It's going to be really fascinating to see what happens.
Absolutely. I think that's where I'm kind of most excited to see where some of this, you know, all these new reinforcement learning kind of methods and stuff like that, you know, really take fruition, is really helping drug design and things like that. You know, it's such a probabilistic process that if you can narrow down the space, the sample space of where you're searching, this molecule might be useful to actually build a drug off of. You can cut down years on the time of what it takes to develop a drug. And I think that's probably the most interesting stuff that AI is going to be able to do soon.
The human story is a story of experimentation and mistakes, and sometimes cool shit shakes out of it,
Oftentimes cool shit shakes out of it.
And certainly the story of drugs is a story of, oops, that thing that was growing on the bread killed all the bacteria in the petri dish.
Yeah.
Or oops, that thing on the bread just made me, you know, see a cactus growing out of the swimming pool, you know, whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, think about the trial and error of mushrooms even. Like, oh, try this. Either this one's going to make me see God or it's going to make me die. But I'm going to take that risk.
It's parts of Brooklyn where they're taking that risk every day.
Right.
Look, it's funny you bring up mushrooms because that is quietly becoming, there's like AI and then there's psychedelic therapy. Mm-hmm. I think these are the two most fascinating interests in the subculture of what's really happening right now under this current, the seams of society.
Yeah, I mean, it's all that stuff's coming back. Psilocybin research, which used to happen in kind of the 60s, I guess. And,
why not, dude?
Ketamine and all that stuff.
Another thing that works, and we have no idea why it works.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of odd how that stuff all got shut down, because it seemed like there were legitimate kind of medical research happening. And I guess, I don't know if it was war on drug. I don't really know the history too well, but it sounds like it was kind of Nixon era stuff that cut out a lot of that research all at once.
Isn't it funny when something starts to work, it stops in this country?
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that's what it was.
I mean, it's like, you know, the most reductionist dumbass argument, which I think is probably true, is like, well, we can't really sell something that grows out of the ground, you know, in a cow pasture.
Right.
So
we don't want the farmers to make money off of this. We want to.
No, but it's like the cannabis industry. Like, so I have a friend, I grew up with this. I can't tell you the whole story, but I grew up with this friend. He was a shady character when we were little kids, and we always knew he's going to be a problem child.
Yeah.
Anyway, turns out he gets the first legal cannabis license in Colorado. He's worth $100 million. This guy, shady beginnings, time the market, crushed it, entrepreneur, something to prove.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went out, I flew out there years later. I hadn't seen him in forever. Hadn't seen him since he became such a huge success. And we sat down, we had pizza and we were talking. And I say, man, you know, everyone's getting into cannabis. Everyone's making money. He goes, no, I made money. No one's going to make money ever again. He goes, do you hear people investing in sugar? I was like, no. He's like, well, you know, cannabis is a plant that grows out of the fucking ground, just like sugar cane. It's going to zero. He goes, do you hear anyone who's just like balling out with wheat?
Yeah.
Or corn?
So we're already past that phase. There's no more. All the wheat moguls are.
All the wheat moguls are toast. I mean, at scale, it's a commodity.
Sure. Yeah.
We're like, okay. You know, you got, and by the way, it's actually a real estate play, but that's a whole different story about crops and fields and all that stuff. Mm. But just going back to that example, it's like, and zipping back to mushrooms, it's, you know, mushrooms, it's going to be a product that there will be a boom at the product level, but then it's just some fucking mushroom.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see people going into Whole Foods and just going, look how much shiitake there is here. It's liquid gold, baby. It's liquid. It's like $4 a pack, right?
I got a friend like that.
Yeah, I bet really you do. Shiitake. I try to say the word shiitake on every single podcast and, you know, without fail, we achieved it.
Good.
So what's the game? Like, it's a fundraising exercise at this point. Is it a sell more shit exercise at this point?
For us?
Yeah.
I mean, fundraising is the least interesting thing to do as a company builder. I think it's such a time sink and it's not fun. And, you know, you'd much rather spend all of your time building product and building.
How much have you guys raised for Blue Onion? Rounds. You don't have to tell me.
Exactly. We've done our, honestly, it would have been called a Series A just a few years ago, but fundraising was so crazy the last 2 years that, you know, people were starting to call it seed. But, you know, we've raised millions at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, when we first got out of YC, we weren't exactly sure. We were still kind of in the phase of, we kind of knew we had done that pivot into, we knew we wanted to, finance and accounting teams were the ones that needed the most help or where we could probably start quickly enough, but we were still very much building that product. And so we didn't want to raise too much in the beginning without knowing
where we're going to go.
Yeah. If you raise too much too quickly, and it's usually kind of a mistake, I would say, for most startups to raise too much without knowing what you're going to do with the capital because.
Thank you. I love to hear that.
Yeah.
I've heard some big time guys say the fucking opposite and it just gives me chills.
There's some kind of thought of you should just build your war chest to be as big as possible and then figure out how to deploy the capital later. And I think that it can cause a lot of lazy thinking because you throw money after problems instead of your brain power
big
a lot
time.
Of times. And you hire too many people.
And you're not hungry.
And you're not
because you know where dinner's coming from.
We'll be fine. We don't have to solve this problem today. We can solve it in 3 months or whatever.
Right. Let's go down and have a $30 yoga class and a $15 smoothie.
Right. Yeah.
Fuck that.
And you know,
the behavior.
But there's like a balance, right? Because you don't want it to be at the point where you are sweating buckets every day of are we going to be around tomorrow?
Right. Survival mode narrows focus. Fat mode, whatever, is laziness. So there's definitely a comfortable mix.
Right. And that's where we kind of debated, you know, what should we take and when? And, you know, none of us are natural marketers either. So, you know, those are, it's been the last 2 years. They did a really good, like those types of founders did very well in being able to raise a ton of money on not a lot of traction and like a crazy valuations, which now you're paying the price for. Because as like multiples have come down, you really have a lot more growth that you have to be able to hit to justify any of the stuff that was happening over the last few years. And so I think it's going to be a tough market for. So we're a little thankful for that.
You're like, aren't you glad you raised $200 million?
But look, I mean, they can still figure it out. I'm sure they're still happy to have the capital, but it's just, unless you can exit before then or someone got to figure out what you're doing, like raising any more capital is really difficult. You dilute yourself like crazy and then it's not fun. It's a downward spiral.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the amount of capital that YC plugs you guys with is probably just enough, maybe a little too much, but it's just the right amount where it's not crazy. The way that I roll is I don't know if I just like torturing. It's like I have to get some kind of product market fit, some feedback that's just how I build my business because I don't have the stomach to say, no, it doesn't. Yeah, I don't know. But we're going to spend another 20, 30, 50, 100, 200, 300 grand on this. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to start to see feedback. I can't take it. I don't know why. I just can't take it.
Yeah. I mean, some projects do require that kind of investment. I mean, take OpenAI, right? Like, it took them how many millions of dollars to build this product, you know, in the end, that is now generating cash for them. But, you know, that's usually the opposite of how most startups operate. You want to get that iterative feedback as quickly as possible. And, you know, to exactly to your point, people talk about product market fit as like this binary switch, right? Either I have it or I don't. And once I have it, I'm going to pour a bunch of capital onto it and I'm going to hire a bunch of people. But it almost never works that way. It's like, it's
a spectrum.
It's concentric circles. Like, I have product market fit with this part of the market. And then I start to build new features that's going to expand this and expand this and expand this. It's much more of an iterative feedback loop than it is this binary switch. And I think people took the lessons of like, the social networks to be like, you know, I have to grow as quickly as possible. I have to build that network really quickly. And product market fit is this binary thing. And it may be in consumer products sometimes, but I think that's the exception to the rule.
Usually. It's funny that you bring that. It's like, that is a popular, for people who love to burn cash, they love to point to social networks. Because social networks was the ultimate, I don't have any fucking clue how this thing is going to make money, but I think it's going to do something eventually.
Yeah. And a few of them, you know, if you're on the right network that wins out, it does generate a lot of cash. They're really hard to dislodge. The network effects are real and they matter a ton. But for the most part, most businesses don't operate that way.
No, that is such a small, little, tiny little sliver of the market with, like you said, network effects that's it. It's just network effects.
Right.
More fucking people here, more enterprise value, period.
Totally. Well, and so the lessons, I think it was applied to things like Uber Eats and like Seamless and Grubhub and DoorDash, but there's no moats to those things, right? Like, they spend a ton of cash trying to build those network effects, but like, every restaurant is on all of those platforms. So like, it's who's giving me the biggest discount and I'll just switch to using that platform, you know, tomorrow. It's very different than what Facebook was, where like, all my friends are only on this one place. I'm really going to go. So the network effects don't really exist there, but they spent, I think,
crazy amounts of money.
Yeah.
I mean, and now we see what is the grasping and the last grasp for air from certain social media platforms, I won't name names, by selling core assets off on a monthly subscription. Read between the lines.
Yeah.
That to me is like selling off the lifeboats right before the fucking ship sinks. They're like, here is the last bit of capital, social capital, you know, it's for sale now. It's for sale. Now the credibility factor of the platform falls apart for brands, for professional content creators, whatever.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay.
It just seems like a lot of those product decisions just weren't well thought through. They were very on a whim. And Yeah. I'm not sure. None of that seemed like a good idea, to be honest.
No. It's a terrible, it's an idea that like, you know, like we all go out with a group of friends and there's always the buddy that kind of like sucks at decision making. It's like they gave it to that guy. You know, it's the guy at the pizza party. You're like, Brandon's fucking something up again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except, you know, Brandon, you know, runs a $40 billion product line.
But Brandon's really good at some things, just not this thing.
He's really good at some things. Yeah. But this thing, they gave him the decision and he blew it.
Yeah. Made it a project and...
God damn it, Brandon.
Not in his wheelhouse.
Yeah. But that's, to me, to kind of like land on the message, the real reason that I do this show is like, nobody has it figured out. The incumbents are just as stupid as you are. The people on the way up are just as stupid as you are. They're in motion. They're willing to make mistakes. They're willing to learn. And that's that, folks. So, you know, if you're sitting around thinking that the incumbents are these warriors, these geniuses, they might be pretty smart, but they're still capable of making the same blunders. Mm-hmm. The difference is your blunders, oh, fuck, I guess I can't eat out tonight, this week, you know? And then their blunders takes out an entire enterprise worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why a lot of startups exist, right, is because these incumbents, they have too much to protect and you're not going to take risks when you don't have to a lot of the time. And so, you know, you find industries that end up sclerotic because once you have three or four winners and they have cornered a market, there's no reason for them to build a lot of new stuff anymore. And they don't.
You know, right.
Everything's a cash cow.
And then we enter a state of decline. What's the famous, the graph? It's like, we're in the cash cow phase and then we enter into the decline. What's the?
I don't know that.
Not we're going to cut this part, guys. What do you mean you don't know that? It's the most famous.
Really?
I'm having deja vu right now. When you just said, I don't know that. I'm like, fuck, this has happened to me before in a dream. This is bullshit.
I'm sorry. I'm not that well read.
Come on, dude. Stuff. Make me look better on this fucking podcast.
I'm sure you're right.
It's like, you know, in marketing 101, it's like, here is the phase of a product. It's like the early adopters, the growth phase, the cash cow phase. I'm going to stop while I'm ahead.
Oh,
but
is the crossing the chasm thing?
We're done. We're going to talk. Listen, man, I would love to keep this chat going. I want to know what you guys are up to. I want to hear the story of Blue Onion. Keep me in the loop.
Absolutely.
Okay. These are the types of products and solutions that are going to make our fucking life easier. These are the things that are going to allow us to make better decisions. These are the things that are going to allow me not to wrestle with Google Analytics for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was a true pleasure, man, to have you on the show. And I wish you the best. Hope to hear from you soon, bro.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah. All right. That's a pod.